Joe got out of the old McAllister pen. There he got his parole. After 4 long years on a man-killing charge, Tom Joad come a-walking down the road. Poor boy, Tom Joad come a-walking down the road. Tom Joad, he met a truck-driving man. There he caught him a ride. He said, I just got loose from McAllister Pen on a charge called homicide. A charge called homicide. That truck rolled away in a cloud of dust. Tommy turned his face toward home. He met Preacher Casey and they had a little drink, but they found that his family, they was gone. He found that his family, they was gone. He found his mother's old-fashioned shoe, found his daddy's hat, and he found little Muley, and Muley said, they've been tractored out by the cats. They've been tractored out by the cats. Tom Joad walked down to the neighbor's farm, found his family. They took Preacher Casey and loaded in a car, and his mother said, we've got to get away. His mother said, we've got to get away. Now the 12 of the Joads made a mighty heavy load, but Grandpa Joad did cry. He picked up a handful of land in his hand, said, I'm staying with the farm till I die. Yes, I'm staying with the farm till I die. They fed him short ribs and coffee and soothing syrup, and Grandpa Joad did die. They buried Grandpa Joad by the side of the road, Grandma on the California side. They buried Grandma on the California side. They stood on a mountain and they looked to the west, and it looked like the promised land. That bright green valley with a river running through, there was work for every single hand. They thought there was work for every single hand.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Is a Bright Future for Healthcare Possible? Dr. Donald Berwick, who studies management of healthcare systems to improve trade-offs among quality, safety, and costs, has concluded that any healthcare funding plan that is just, equitable, civilized, and humane must be redistributional of wealth from the richer among us to the poor and the less fortunate.
Yes.
Could you make some comments on what will be the ramifications for the Affordable Care Act and healthcare in general if we do or do not go over quote unquote or the fiscal cliff? Thank you.
The fiscal cliff is all the rage now. It's the particular moment we're in which a series of policies that Congress created are converging in January, and then we had a debt limit problem in a month or two later. The consequence of implementation of existing law would be a rise in taxes and a decrease in funding for important programs, and people are very worried that that would tip us into a recession. It's important and needs to be dealt with. We'll watch Congress do something to help us get through this interval, I hope. But I think what I can most importantly tell you is that the bigger job here, with the healthcare piece of it, which is all I can talk about, is to reorganize American healthcare so as to better meet the needs of patients and families and reduce costs through reducing waste. If we do that, not this fiscal cliff, but the next one and the one after that will be far less steep because we will have brought under control an out-of-control sector exactly the right way by doing exactly what helps every single individual. That's the best option I could offer. With respect to the Affordable Care Act overall, it has potential for that. It supports an innovation fund. It rebalances us toward community-based care. It begins to reward hospitals and doctors more for doing what really works, providing quality. It's outcome-oriented. There's a lot in there, but it's going to take some time for the Affordable Care Act to kick in and offer us that chance for change. It's not going to happen by January.
Good evening. Thanks for your words. I come to a lot of these gatherings, and you're discussing health care tonight. I've heard a lot of talks on finance. I've heard talks on education, etc. What I'm hearing is that America is rotting, and capitalism is not working the way it was designed to work, or maybe it is. That's another topic. But what I'm hearing is that we've turned into a nation of money whores. And therein lies the problem, and it's infected most of our institutions. Like you said, I think the cure has to come from each person in this room and in other rooms like this one. I'd like to hear your comment about that.
Well, I think we have some serious problems in healthcare. That's what I've been talking about. I would never go so far as to say the nation is rotting. The reason I'm spending time talking with you is that I think we're a great nation which can solve a problem when it gets its head around the problem. We can get to the moon, but we have to decide to do it, and this is where we are right now. The nation's facing a choice that our political world is unable to grapple with quite in the best way right now, which is why you all mobilized for the kind of health care we want is so promising. I have great confidence we can solve this problem. Now, profit, I spoke in my talk about out-of-control profit, which appears as greed. Absolutely. That's how could you take billions of dollars from a suffering Medicaid program just in the interest of revenue? We should have different rules that make that impossible. But the way I think about the profit right now in healthcare is it's sort of like it's like a pitcher and a batter. If you keep throwing fastballs, they'll hit fastballs. If you want a different behavior, you have to throw a different pitch. And the pitch we're throwing to the healthcare production system now says, what's good? More volume, more procedures, do more things to people, keep your hospital beds full, more. That's the pitch we're throwing. The argument now is throw a different pitch. How about a healthcare system that says more health is better, not more things, that more comfort and relief is better, not just doing the next thing to a person, that basing what you do on science is better than just throwing whatever you can at the problem. I think that would be a better system. And I think if we could write a rule base, private and public sector, around better health, better care, better outcomes, more dignity, we would see an American economy, a healthcare economy that could rise to that occasion and hit that pitch. So in some ways, I have trouble holding this delivery system accountable for playing the game the way the rule book was written. We need a new rule book, and that's the point. George?
Ralph Brindis, past president, American College of Cardiology. Dr. Berwick, first of all, thank you for your inspirational words. Visionary and leaders of the healthcare society in the world of the nation really regret that the national treasure that you are is not in Washington leading CMS at this time. I want to comment about one of your monsters. You talked about Hubert Humphrey's words at the HHS building, that is the uninsured that we're trying to get coverage through expansion of Medicaid. And the national discussion that's going on, we have all these states that are just refusing to do such, taking on the uninsured, worried about states' cost. Yet we learned in the New England Journal commentary just a couple months ago, these are about lives, that when we expand care, we actually save lives. How do we change the dialogue in the United States that we can expand Medicaid to the uninsured in all these states that are refusing to do such?
States who bear a substantial portion of Medicaid costs are reeling right now in their own economic problems. A governor of any political persuasion would have to be thinking hard about what choices to make. It will be schools or health care or roads or schools. And these trade-offs are very difficult ones. So I have respect for those governors who are trying, those legislatures and states that are trying to solve the problem. My plea is, as we do that, as we decide where to put the priorities, a great and civilized nation should take care of the least advantaged among them. We are responsible for each other. That's the way I see it. At Medicare and Medicaid, at CMS, I got to care every day about 100 million Americans in the dawn of life, the shadows of life, the vulnerable among us. And I'm just saying, please understand that in this particular era of choice, the vulnerable have little power. They don't vote as often. They don't contribute to political campaigns. They don't organize PACs. They don't write op-eds. It has to be the rest of society that says, as Senator Humphrey would have us say, we've got your back. And this isn't just about health care. This is about every domain in which the basic agenda is people who you pass in the street without homes, without sufficient resources to get themselves organized. They're us, and we have to reorient our priorities toward them. It isn't simple. Of course it's not simple, but I think it's the right thing to do. Right now in Medicaid, it's the smart thing to do also, I must say, because a state that chooses not to engage in Medicaid expansion is, number one, leaving 100% federal match dollars on the table for 3 years, and then 95 and then 90, leaving it on the table. These patients don't go away. They still show up in the emergency room. They still end up in the hospital bed. Paid for how? By free care pools, public charity, other sources of state opportunity. It doesn't just make any sense at all. So Medicaid as a public investment is the right thing to do, and it's the smart thing to do, and I just hope that sanity will return.
I was given license by George to ask one more question, if I could. My question is whether we'll ever achieve true reform without fully taking into consideration the mental aspects of disease, both in terms of its cause and potential cure. For instance, I'm reminded of the ongoing research being done here in the Bay Area linking moral sentiments such as gratitude, forgiveness, and compassion with better health.
Well, seeking better health is all about behaviors. There's four times as much health change in the behaviors you seek than in the healthcare you get. 400% more leverage from what you eat, how you exercise, the violence in society, inequities, four times as much influence on health status as anything medicine does. We have the data. We know it's there. So that's where the leverage is. The more narrow point about behavioral health, behavioral sciences, mental health care in the healthcare system is crucially important. That was one of the marginalized areas of healthcare. It's not procedural. It's hard to get paid for it. And yet we know that organizations like NUCA that invest in behavioral health in the team, in the center, they get much, much better results. A depressed diabetic patient costs 240% more to care for a year than a non-depressed diabetic patient. What does your logic tell you? Maybe putting behaviorists in the care of diabetes would be a very good investment, and it would be. This return to health and outcomes and recovery away from volume-based thinking would lead us there automatically. Thank you very much.
And that ties this program into several others that we've had with the Humanities Forum lately, where we pointed out that some very successful ideas are sometimes cause problems. The 20th century has an idea that if we can't measure it, we can't know it, because we've been so good at measuring it, but it gets in the way sometimes. So our thanks to Donald Berwick for his comments today. We also thank our audiences here live in San Francisco, as well as those listening online or on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Red house of yonder, where my people stay. Red house, oh yonder, where my people stay. I haven't seen my baby 99 one half day. Hey, my tea. One arm like a door. Something wrong. My key, I put it locked no more. I'm leaving my baby. Change the lock on my door. It's you. I ain't seen my baby. 99. Haven't seen my baby. 99, one half days, one half days. Way, way, way back over yonder. Watch, she used to live. Little blue. red house over yonder. My baby used to stay. I ain't seen my baby, that night in one half day. Think we're way back on the hill. Hey, I'm going way back across the hill. Well, where my baby stay. I'm going way back over yonder across the hill. Where my baby stay. I know she won't. I know her sister will. She don't, if she don't, I know her, her sister will. You, my sister will, my sister will. If she don't love me, I know.
Coming up next, chemicals that promote obesity down the generations. Diet and exercise are seen as key factors that cause obesity, but new research suggests that certain chemicals contribute to the global weight problem. Bruce Bloomberg at University of California at Irvine tells Steve Curwood that the effects of these chemicals seem to persist for several generations.
From the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios in Boston, this is Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. Conventional wisdom says overeating and the lack of exercise are behind the obesity epidemic in America and much of the world. But that's not the whole story, according to some new research from the University of California, Irvine, that implicates certain chemicals called obesogens. Here's Professor Bruce Blumberg.
An obesogen, according to us, is a chemical that somehow causes the body to store more fat. And it can do that by making more fat cells, by putting more fat into those cells, or can do that indirectly by changing how the metabolism works, or by making you hungrier, or by making you less able to sense that you've had enough to eat.
Bruce Blumberg is a professor of developmental biology at UC Irvine. And here's the startling part of his research. Not only has his team confirmed earlier work showing that certain persistent organic pollutants can act as obesogens, they have also found that initial exposures can echo down through at least three generations to make animals fat. This study used the chemical TBT, tributyltin, which was widely used as an anti-fouling paint until a few years ago.
So we exposed pregnant mice to very low doses of tributyltin, and we knew from our previous work that that would give us effect on the babies who were so exposed. We would call that the F1 generation. And we asked the question, what happens if we bred those babies and the babies of those babies and checked whether there were subsequent effects?
And what happened?
So what we found is that the effects persisted in the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren, and that some of the effects were actually stronger in the great-grandchildren who had never been exposed.
So how much fatter were these animals compared to your controls?
It depends on which part of the fat that we looked at. So the effect on the fat in different parts of the body was different, but some of the so-called fat depots were twice as big. Overall, the animals were probably about 15% fatter.
Now, this study used lab mice. How well do you think these findings might translate to humans?
100%.
Really?
The reason I say that is because tributyltin, TBT, works through a hormone receptor called PPAR-gamma. And we know that there are pharmaceutical drugs that target that same receptor that make people fat. So if I have a chemical, tributyltin, that activates the same receptor, you would expect the same effect.
So walk me through the actual physiological process of how a chemical like a tributyltin works to become an obesogen.
So as much as we know about tributyltin, it activates this hormone receptor, PPAR-gamma, and PPAR gamma works as a, it has a partner. So it works as a dimer, has two parts. And the other part of that is called RXR, retinoid X receptor. So if TBT happens to get into a stem cell and PPAR gamma RXR is there, it activates that complex and it turns on a set of genes that cause the cell to become a fat cell. And along with that comes the ability to store lipids, to store fats. If PPAR gamma is not there, that stem cell will become a bone cell.
One of the most startling things that's in your report is your citation of a study that showed, and I quote, 8 different species of animals, including pets, laboratory animals, and feral rats, living in proximity to humans, have become obese in parallel with the human obesity epidemic, and that the odds of this being coincidence were something like 10 million to 1 against?
10 million to 1, yes.
So what does that mean in your eyes about the human obesity epidemic?
You can make the argument, if you talk to the mainstream obesity community, they will make the argument that it's all about diet and exercise, calories in, calories out. And I don't see how you can explain the increase in obesity of animals, including wild animals, by calories in, calories out. It's got to be something else. It has to be the nature of the calories. It has to be a chemical, an environmental factor to which they're exposed now that they were not previously exposed to that underlies that.
So who is most susceptible to tributyltin exposure?
Tributyltin will make animals and humans fat at any stage of life. We're particularly concerned with prenatal exposures because that's where you have the capability to have transgenerational effects. You won't cause, or we don't believe that you will, exposing an adult will cause transgenerational effects on their offspring. But we know from our experiments that exposing embryos to a chemical like tributyltin will cause transgenerational effects.
So, Professor Blumberg, tell me that I might need a couple of notches on my belt. Maybe I could blame on my mother or my grandmother even?
I don't know that you could blame it on them, but what your mother or grandmother was exposed to will affect the efficiency with which you handle calories. It's well known that obese people have more efficient metabolisms. They store a higher proportion of the calories that they eat. Obviously, they do eat more, but they also store more of every calorie that they eat as fat compared with non-obese people. So that's an example of what we call metabolic programming.
So what does that say now, thinking of our social policy in dealing with human health and obesity?
It says to me that the most important way that we can change obesity is not by treating obese people, but by preventing people from becoming obese in the first place, by preventing these exposures, which can include chemical exposures, but they can also include exposures to improper diet. There is a fair bit of data out there that says exposing mom to a high fat or a junk food diet makes the babies prefer that kind of food. There's some kind of a programming event that's not well understood that's going on there. So it's not just chemical exposure. It's chemical exposure and dietary factors and the nature of diet early in life that I think is the area that needs to be addressed to make inroads into solving this obesity problem that we face today.
And what about the folks who are already chubby?
Well, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't help them, but I think that we're better off preventing them from becoming chubby. You know, there's a lot of data out there that suggests that 90% of people who lose even a significant amount of weight will gain it back. And that's also a very important factor here. Imagine you're a person who's worked very hard. You've dieted hard. You've exercised hard. You've lost 150 pounds. You look and feel better than you ever have in your life. Why is there going to be 90% probability that you gain that weight back?
And the answer is?
The answer is to me that it's not strictly behavior. It's a metabolic programming, that your body is programmed to behave in a certain way by your early life experiences, and that it's very difficult to fight that.
Dr. Bruce Blumberg is a professor of developmental and cell biology at the University of California in Irvine. Thanks so much, Professor.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war? where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our blessed with peace.